So it's week seven. So the first thing I wanted to say is really start thinking already about how you're going to continue. I mean, this course is an 8-week course, but I'm trying to, in the book, cover the whole spiritual life, which is called why it's called A Practical Guide to Enlightenment. It's a bit ambitious to think you can do that in 8 weeks, but hopefully what you'll get is a what you've got already. And I was really struck by my group how much actually they're putting it into practice. I mean, that coffee story, very striking, but just a sort of small story, but really kind of, there we are, there's our coffee. I don't know what your name is, sorry. Yeah. A very striking story that it, just by changing your mind just a tiny bit, and in this case, just noticing your trigger of reaction, not just flowing with that. So often what we do, isn't it, we just flow with our triggers of reaction. We all have triggers of reaction, and they go much deeper than we realize. We've managed to make life fairly comfortable for us, most of us actually. So there's not anywhere near as many triggers as there might be. But they're all just lying below the surface. All it can take sometimes is someone to push in you in your queue and you feel hugely indignant. All that happened in that little story is noticing a trigger of reaction. Somebody's pushing in front of you and not running with it, not flowing with it. You've cultivated enough mindfulness in that first stage and enough emotional strength or positive emotion just to notice that's the way your mind wants to run. And you decide that you don't need to run with it. You feel the reaction flare up. And sometimes it can flare up very, very strongly. And what you were saying in the group was that actually once you felt that trigger and not flown with it, it's quite easy then to be kind. It's quite easy then to, once you don't go with the initial reaction, you've got a space opens up where you can notice the person. And you can see, gosh, they just look in a state. They're not doing it to me. It's an interesting little story because what we tend to think is they're pushing in front of me. But they're not pushing in front of you. They're just pushing in front of someone. Do you see what I mean? When you do it, you don't think, who shall I push in front of? Oh, the one who has, authority problems. That would be a good one to push in front of. The one who's having a hard day, they're just pushing in front of someone. No one's pushing in front of you. They haven't singled you out to push in front of. But that's how it feels. And when you notice that flare-up reaction, if you can not run with it, it opens a space for you to see the world in a different way. Because you see the world in a different way, it affects other people. And quite quickly, you start to change events. Like if you had reacted, she would have reacted more. And before you know it, you would have sent that out into the world more, and you would have got back to the office and say, oh, God, you'd never believe what happened. And then, yes, that would have reminded somebody else about when it happened to them, and she would have gone to her and said, I can't hear this woman, she really went. We'd be sending ripples of ill will through London. You could probably feel them now. But just like that, you can send ripples of positivity so that this woman said, well, can I buy you a cake? So I thought it was fantastic. So that's what we're first of all trying to. Do you see how the first thing we're trying to do, and again this came up in the group, it really struck me, is that we're trying to develop a kind of faith. Faith isn't the best word, but a confidence that if we want life to go better, we need to change how we act. We need to first of all be more mindful. We need to notice those trigger reactions. Notice our mood going low, notice us getting intoxicated, the other side of that. It's easy to talk about the negatives, isn't it? But sometimes intoxication is just as dangerous. If you're mindful, you can think, I've now gone into a fantasy and I'm going to fall out of this. So you notice that sort of self-intoxication. Once you notice, as soon as you notice, you can start to make wiser choices about how you act. And then your mind changes, and then the world changes. And the first thing we're doing is trying to cultivate a faith in that. It's a sense that all I need to have to deepen my life, to flourish my life, is a belief, a faith, a confidence that if I act in accordance with what Buddhism would call karma nirma processes, it sounds horrendously technical, but if I act out of awareness rather than unawareness, positive emotion rather than negative emotion, and so on, my consciousness arises in a different way. I become a different person and I change the world. Yeah. So the first part of this course is all about trying to cultivate that faith that actions have consequences, that the actions, and remember in Buddhism it's of body, speech and mind, the thoughts we think, the things we say or not don't say, the actions we run into or don't run into, create who we are every moment. If we don't have faith in that, do you see how we'll want to fall back on thinking that the answer is to go back into your childhood and sort out all your problems from there? Or you'll think the answer is to seek expert help of some, you know, some sort of technical thing. Really what we need faith in is in action. That if I work with my mind and start to notice my reactive patterning, step out of it in this way that we've been learning, if I can make wiser choices, particularly in relationship to other people, my consciousness will change itself. I don't really need to change my consciousness, it just changes itself. And very often that, like in your story, affects the world around you, sometimes really very immediately. And you know, if you contrast that with being on the tube, I was being on the tube, but it's very crowded the other day, and somebody knocked into somebody, and somebody was immediately, you know, over-exasperated. And you could feel it rippling through the tube. And so, it wasn't that bad. You know, everyone starts to get a bit indignant. Everybody calm, we're all right, we're fine, aren't we? We haven't even got to Liverpool Street yet, you know. Chill out, chillax, you know. But you see how it's a practice. We need to ongoingly notice the state of mind we're in. That's that first key stage of awareness, of integration. Really take ownership. Oh, I'm now in a bad mood. So I now have to be a bit careful with what I think. I have to be a bit careful with what I say to people. Or now I'm in a full of myself mood and I now have to be a bit careful of what I think and have to be a bit careful of buttonholing people with my thing I want to talk about. Do you see how it works either way? On the basis of that kind of integration, this kind of taking ownership of our life, we then try to think, I can contribute. And even that contribution, the awareness itself is a contribution, the fact that you didn't react, you didn't flow with that reaction, is a contribution to her life, a complete stranger's life. And in that moment, changes it a bit. It's a real change. Changes it a little tiny bit. And you see how in very small ways, very, very small ways, each moment we could become part of the solution or part of the problem. That's a terribly difficult matter of life, isn't it? Is there isn't anywhere else to be. You're either acting out the solution and spreading that a bit, or you're acting out the problem and spreading that. And every micro moment is that's what's happening. And by golly, does the world need a solution? And that's not a different opinion usually, it's a different mindset set. Yeah. It's a different attitude to life. So do you see that those first two stages are all about really making use of the fact that the universe is structured in a certain way to prefer the good. It's really, when you think about it philosophically, not that I've been able to very much, but there's a philosophical question here for those of you philosophically inclined. But how is it that we live in a universe that prefers the good? You know, and you see it in the greatest place. I saw that film of Macbeth recently, and the other thing that really struck me is at the end of the play, Macbeth is saying, because I've done these terrible, here are the things I can't expect to have. And one of the things is troops of friends. I can't remember. He says, he just goes through a list of the things that I can't expect to have. Because of my actions, you know, I'm a king, but I haven't got any friends. So I got what I wanted, but actually I never wanted this terrible alone. He also can't sleep. One of the great, it's interesting, there's a theme in Shakespeare, this, obviously he must have had problems with sleeping because it's one of his great horrors is you can't sleep. So Macbeth says, I can't have a troop of, you know, troop of friends. That's something I can't expect to have. So it's all trying to say that, yeah, you can act negatively. That's up to you. But it has consequences, natural consequences. They're not ordained by God. They're not, there's not a guardian angel balancing it out and so on. It just is like you send a ripple off into the universe and that comes back to you. If you jolt into somebody in the tube, they'll probably jolt back into you. If you react to the person standing in front of you, they'll probably react back. And then they'll probably react to other people after that, and you'll send it out. Yeah. So we're in a universe, whether you like it or not, and frankly I sometimes really don't like it, is that it prefers the good. It prefers patience to impatience, courage to timidity, emotional strength to emotional weakness, awareness to unawareness.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
How do you know that the universe prefers it?
Yeah. And
it's just better for us to live like that.
Well, the only accurate answer is you don't know. The universe is a weird abstraction, because where is it? Presumably it's here and everywhere, isn't it? Yes. The reason I want to put it like that is because I think it's more than something psychological. It's not just that you feel better for it. When you act in accordance with karma and nirma processes, I think it's part of the structuring of reality, just as gravity. Even though we know that theory doesn't quite hold true, even though we know there are all sorts of problems with it and scientists and philosophers are still trying to work out what must be really happening, it's meant that you can invent the space rocket and the plane and do all kinds of things. There's something about the structure of the universe, at least as we experience it, where the idea of gravity helps you use it, if you see what I mean. Karma nirma process is saying that when it comes to self-aware individuals, you and I, consciousness creates a sort of structuring in which if you act negatively, it doesn't work, if you see what I mean. It's saying really that apples fall from trees, and if you act negatively, things happen painfully, if you see what I mean. You can't really go any further than saying why that is. But it's true whether you believe it or not. It's true whether you like it or not. It's not culturally assigned, not at its depths at least. I think of it, and Buddhism thinks of it, as actually part of the structuring of reality. Whatever that can mean, if you see what I mean. But I think it's more than psychology. That's why I want to evoke the universe, which is certainly a big thing to evoke. Yeah, see, even something like this, we pause over positive and negative. It's nowhere near as easy as it sounds. You know, my story was of Jan of Archer telling me to stop writing a book once. You know, I had been writing this book for months every day on a sabbatical, and he read it, the manuscript, after I'd been working on it for 3 months, solidly, like all day, every day, 3 months. And he said, I am neither impressed with the book or with you. You go... it was a very, very strong experience. I really wanted to just say, well, you I wanted to say something more Anglo-Saxon than I'm usually given to. But what strikes me looking back is the act of enormous kindness. The book I was trying to write really didn't suit me and didn't work. It was making me unhappy. And there I was on this precious sabbatical, not making the best, spiritually the best of it. It was a very, very kind action. But it doesn't look like one on the level. But that same someone saying, I'm not impressed with the book or with you, could be a very unkind action. because it's really to do with jealousy. You see, it's all to do with your motivation. It's really to do with the fact you're jealous of the pork, or actually you're just a bit threatened because they're not giving you enough attention. They're writing this book rather than talking to you all the time. You see how Buddhist ethics, I don't like the word ethics, but Buddhist intentionality is to do with what you're trying to do. He was just trying to tell me the truth and trying to say, I really don't think this is helping you. But you need to have quite a strong friend who's willing to do that. So even this word positive and negative needs a lot of reflection about what we mean by it. Basically, from a Buddhist point of view, it means whatever, something's positive if it helps you move towards enlightenment, which might be different to something that you like, agree with, pleasurable.
Hopefully he didn't say the same about this book.
No, of course. Who said that? I just heard a voice from... Anyway, no, he thought it was marvellous. But it has admitted he's not read it. but I will... you know, I will continually look, you know, crestfallen every time I talk to him about it. So even that has to be explored, yeah? And a lot of practicing the Dharma life is working out how you work with these patterns. It's not something you can just tick off on a rule book. It's a certain sort of spirit. Very, very difficult. You can't pin it down. Sometimes you can even command people to do things, and it's very, very positive indeed. I managed to do it a few times in my life where I've just commanded someone. I just said, stop it now and sit down and talk to me, what's going on? And done it in such a way as that they couldn't not do that. It's very, very positive if you can do it positively. Usually our ideas of positivity are far too sort of trivial, really. But nevertheless, you can even use that not to just be generous, not react to first someone in a queue and all that sort of thing, which is not it either. So somehow you're first of all learning about this great matter of how your actions are having consequences and creating your life and creating the lives of those around you. And how you never get a chance, do you, to park up and think about that, because it's always happening. You're always in the middle of a film and you don't know where you are in the plot. You don't even know who the goodies and the baddies are, but somehow you have to react and respond fruitfully, helpfully, positively. You see how the word positive becomes then, if you think about it. You're trying to get the best out of life, and the Buddha figure represents the best out of life. So you're trying to get everything in life to move in that direction. Incredibly ambitious, but that is what we want. We're not satisfied unless that's happening, whether we're writing a novel, or whether we're writing a poem, whether we're directing a film, whether we're in a business meeting, whether we're walking home from this class tonight, whether we're on the tube, whether we're waiting to get served at a cafe. We're trying to get the best out of life all the time, not just our life, but the life of everyone. And then you see that's the first great structuring of life, and it comes back to you really strongly. When you do that, you can expect to have a troop of friends. You can. These are things you can expect. You could have an anti-Macbeth where these are the things I can expect. The people I look up to most, and I'm fortunate to have people I do look up to very much, that's what they can expect. They've already got it, and they can expect more of that. They can expect to be trusted. They can expect for friends to be loyal to them. Not all the time, because some friends aren't loyal. Life isn't fair in a certain way. Yeah? But that is what a really human life is, wants to be. Even if you don't know it, that's really what you want. You want the best of life. But what I'm trying to get to in these later stages in the book is this other structuring of the universe, to bring in that big thing again, which is what we're calling Dharma Nirma processes. Much more difficult to talk about, but without some taste of them, this karma nirma processes, this positive action, tends to fall back into just a comfort thing, a me thing. There is within life, there is within all of our life, a current that takes us beyond life. that takes us beyond who we think we are, what we think life is, takes us beyond time and causality. I mean, when you talk about it, thinking, sounds nuts. but there really is. I've experienced it. It's distinct from you, but not separate to you. There is within us, as it were, a current, a stream, that leads beyond us, which you can feel pulling on you. It's actually there now. The very fact you're here tells you that it's there now. That in your life you felt, perhaps very, very subtly, and sometimes by its absence, a current wanting to go beyond you. Otherwise, it'd be better not to come. There's lots of other things you can be doing in London. There's a current in life that goes beyond your life. And what working at karma nirma level does is it makes egotism softer, quieter, thinner, less dogmatic in the philosophical sense, less self-infatuated, less self-preoccupied. And it means that this other current of life, this other structuring of life, can pull upon you much more easily. It's pulling upon you now, but lots of other things are as well. It's here in the room just now, a current that eventually leads to Buddhahood, to configure it in that way. But there are lots of other pressures on your life now. You want a job, you want a partner, you want someone to tell you a joke, you know, you want to not get ill, you want all sorts of stuff at the moment. But there's another current that wants this, actually. You might not figure it like that in your mind, but there's another current. The more you work on the karma element of your experience, that structuring, you'll start to feel this other current more directly. And it is felt. It's not an idea. It's not a theory. It's not even a Buddhist theory. So you'll experience it most when you're on retreat. So as I've been really recommending, already think of booking a retreat. Don't think of booking a retreat, just do one. There's this weekend coming up, there's a winter retreat coming up. There's a men's intensive meditation retreat next year sometime. There's a women's intensive meditation retreat next year sometime. Somebody in my group was saying they put aside some money to go on the women's intensive retreat next year. I don't even know when it is. And that's a really sensible thing to do. That's where you start to most readily feel in touch with a current that takes you beyond life, which when you feel even a touch of it, it makes life feel completely worth living. And the absence of it feels like a terrible hole. It's why artists are so committed to their work. It's because through their work, they feel in touch with something at their best, even if they don't often get to their best, that takes them where they can discover a creation that they could never do with their ordinary mind. Any artist is trying to get into that thing. They're trying to touch that current that takes them into a new range of capacity that they don't have. And if you can do that, what happens? That an artist will feel that, I just don't know how I did that, and I bet you I can't do it again. Because they haven't done it. The person they think they are hasn't done it. They've been in touch with something that's just taken them a bit beyond themselves. Yeah? So really what we're getting into, and what we're getting into this week and next week, the simplest way of talking about that is your imagination. The imagination is our great human faculty. It's the faculty that means that you can imagine what it's like to push in front of someone and imagine the state of mind so that you can act on that imagination and change that person's experience. And it's the imagination that can mean that we can enter into a ritual later on if you want to stay. It's imagination that takes an artist from just doing the sort of thing they do, he or her, she does, into another world. It's our great capacity is that we can imagine. Really, all of the Dharma life is really a life of discovering and uncovering and making more and more vivid our imagination. I can't remember where I've talked about this, but recently I've been thinking about the imaginative team. I talked about this here because I've been talking all over the place. But when I was helping project manage the centre, when we did the rebuild, we built the new reception and the bookshop, and we'd had a design for the bookshop, but it was really not very good. Didn't really work. Really late on in the project, there was lots of pressure on the project. A new architect called a meeting, and we only had like an hour and a half, I think. And we had to completely redesign the bookshop, the whole space, without time to do it. So we got the builder, the carpenter, myself, an architect, and a sort of young architect who just joined the firm. One of the things what struck me, we'd all been working together for a long time, so we were in this really, we knew each other well and liked each other and respected each other. So, you know, I've never worked in architecture, but I tell you what, I've got lots of opinions. And by then, they actually were quite keen to hear them. The carpenter, this sort of young Polish guy, not that much English, but a real sense of what can be built. The architect with a real sense of, okay, what we can do together. We had this like miraculous meeting. I don't know whether you've ever had one of these, where in an hour, we not only solved the problem of the first design, we went far beyond anything that any of us could have thought of. It was fantastic. We had the right people in the right room. We had this imaginative meeting. And it was really fulfilling. I really thought, gosh, if we could have more of these meetings, we could do just about anything. And it's so often in a meeting at work that the imagination's not stepped in. So you're not functioning very well. Usually the reason you're not functioning very well is because there's not enough integration and there's not enough emotional strength. So someone's reacting to someone, or somebody can't listen to someone's suggestion because it threatens them. So the imagination can't step in. Often imagination steps in between people, not in people. When you have an imaginative meeting, all kinds of things are solved very, very easily. Not only are they solved, but you think, let's do another one tomorrow. Let's build a motorway tomorrow. Let's work out what we're going to do with the National Health Service. You know, if imagination steps in, which is based on integration and positive emotion, and especially if it steps in a group of people, your capacity is like squared, it's doubled, it's trebled. Ideas move and change and shift and reconstitute very, very quickly, very naturally. I don't know whether you've ever had this. It's really quite wonderful. But you see how I want to use that, because it's a work meeting. It's about building stuff. It's under quite a lot of pressure. Easily we think of the imagination as about standing in front of a canvas or toying with our unwritten novel. It's actually usually more like in a meeting that we're trying to find the imagination. So what I want us to be doing this week is really thinking, well, I want our basics, which are, can I book a retreat? Am I meditating every day? Can I be doing something in the day that's cultivating mindfulness? So in other words, try to do something every day that's cultivating those first two stages, mindfulness, awareness, integration, emotional strength, kusala karma, whatever we want to call it. And then what sparks off your imagination? Where does your imagination take flight? I've written a lot about it in the book, and so do read it. It's a bit embarrassing to keep on telling people to read my book. But actually, I read it. I thought, God, that's really good. It's not me. I'm only typing it in my bedroom. It's all the things I've learned from my own teachers and so on. But, you know, I find myself, I can teach me, I read it, and think, oh, that's very good. I feel a bit more inspired. May as well be by somebody else, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, so read it. But the important thing to say about imagination, and I'll say more about it next week, is that imagination always takes you a little bit beyond yourself. That's how you know it's imagination. A lot of what we think is imagination is just fancy, is what Coleridge calls fancy. And fancy is just where you mix up things in a kind of arbitrary way. And it looks striking at first, but there's no deeper purchase online. It doesn't take you beyond yourself, and you don't end up with something deeper, truer, more coherent, more whole. So in the book I use the example, you know, you could write a poem about a zebra using underarm deodorant. And it's an unusual immediate idea, but it's just fancy. It will never tell you anything more about underarm deodorant or zebras or life. You know what I mean? I mean, it might do if you can pull it off. Bring it next week. I'm a very fierce critic. Usually it's just a fanciful idea. We're looking for not fancy, which can be even become virtuosic. I've known some artists who can do wonderful things, but you're left feeling, yeah, but there's no deeper purchase there. I keep on using art analogies, and then that's why I wanted that meeting. But I remember reading some other poetry, and then I read a poem by Seamus Heaney, really simple English. But you felt imagination step in as you read it. You felt something deeper, truer, more integral, more resonant, more reliable in a strange sort of way. Feels like it's properly built. Oh, there's all sorts of sort of symptoms of it.
Sorry.
Go on. Where are you going?
Oh, yeah. In relation to forgiveness.
So yeah, yeah.
I wonder if those two things are actually quite similar in a way, but forgiveness can go a lot deeper because it might be something you've been holding on to for
yes.
a long time.
Yeah.
Can you say anything around that?
Well, forgiveness is a spiritual death practice.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to die to forget, to forgive. It's interesting, they say you should forgive but not forget. Mm. Forgiveness is always keep on... renouncing the desire to retaliate. And you have to feel it burn through you, that I want to retaliate and I'm not going to. And I'm going to try to understand. Imagination is a spiritual rebirth practice, is try to imagine why somebody would behave like that. And trying to put yourself in their shoes. If you see what I mean.
So maybe you need some of the imagination in order to...
To forgive, yeah, very often, yeah.
So when you talked about... Because you said somewhere about... To do with, like, the role of parents and that through Buddhism and meditation, a lot of people develop a better relationship with parents.
Yeah, very often, yeah. You have been reading the book, haven't you?
working on not needing to have therapy because it's about working on your mind in the present. So I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot in that, but I wouldn't make a blanket not needing to have therapy. I think some people do find that valuable, but just to say about parents again, parents is an integration practice. At least one way of thinking of it is.
Yeah.
If you're out of harmony with your parents, you're out of harmony with yourself.
Yeah.
However your parents have behaved, 50% of your characteristics are genetic. So if you're against your parents, you are against yourself. What I notice, nearly everyone I've noticed who develops as a Buddhist, their relationship with their parents improve. Just seems to be almost axiomatic. Even if they don't try to, somehow the relationship with their parents improves. Sometimes very, very markedly. I mean, my relationship with my parents was fine. It wasn't great, but it really improved. I just felt much more grateful to them. I felt more understanding of the issues, what they were having. I was able to imagine what I was like for them.
So the imagination, yeah.
It keeps on stepping in. You can't live a really decent life without it. It's our great quality, yeah? So what we're looking for is, can we notice where can we notice where in our life our imagination steps in? How could we cultivate the imagination in your life? Now, one traditional way is to use the arts. That's what the arts have always been about. It's nothing to do with class or race or gender. It's just to do with about giving your imagination food. It's imagination food. And some of that food is really bad, and really like drinking Coke and hot dogs. Some of it's really good. It's like organic veg, you know. So you're just going to try and see if you can improve your imaginative diet this week.
The
That's one way of working on your imagination. But are there situations in your life where you need to imagine the other person more, for instance? Where is your life kind of knocking up against you? And is that a failure of imagination on your part? Can you imagine what it's like for them? If you can't, they find it very difficult to feel that you're sympathetic to them, because they know that you're not really, you don't imagine them really. So see if you can work out this week. So let's see if we can do our daily meditation. And I'm bringing in a new meditation on this, which is, again, a more spiritual death, rebirth meditation. See if you can do something to cultivate mindfulness in the day. See if you can do something quite explicitly to cultivate your imagination. So what I want you to do now is just turn into threes. become a three. I was trying to avoid that. Become a three person. And see how you could cultivate your imagination this week. And try and distinguish that between fancy or fantasy. Fantasy is different as well. Fantasy is just wish fulfillment. Imagination always takes you beyond yourself. Yeah. So let's just do that for a few.